Chapter 11. The music was coming from Gaten, the nice little village Paxack had recommended as a place to stop. It was not nearly as loud as the AC/DC concert Clay had gone to in Boston as a teenager. That had left his ears ringing for days, but it was loud enough to make him think of summer band concerts he'd attended in South Berwick with his parents. In fact, he had it in his mind that they would discover the source of the music on the Gaten Town Common. Likely some elderly person, not a phone crazy but disaster-addled, who had taken it into his head to serenade the ongoing exodus with easy-listening oldies played through a set of battery-powered loudspeakers. There was a Gaten Town Common, but it was deserted, save for a few people eating either a late supper or an early breakfast by the glow of flashlights and Coleman lanterns. The source of the music was a little farther to the north. By then, Lawrence Welk had given way to someone blowing a horn so mellow it was soporific.
"That's Wynton Marsalis, isn't it?" Clay asked.
He was ready to call it quits for the night, and thought Alice looked done almost to death.
"Him or Kenny G?" Tom said. "You know what Kenny G said when he got off the elevator, don't you?"
"No," Clay said, "but I'm sure you'll tell me."
"Man, this place rocks,"
Clay said. "That's so funny, I think my sense of humor just imploded."
"I don't get it," Alice said.
"It's not worth explaining," Tom said.
"Listen, guys, we've got to call it a night. I'm about kilt."
"Me too," Alice said. "I thought I was in shape from soccer, but I'm really tired."
"Yeah,"
Clay agreed.
"Baby makes three."
They had already passed through Gaten's shopping district, and according to the signs, Main Street, which was also Route 102, had now become Academy Avenue. This was no surprise to Clay because the sign on the outskirts of town had proclaimed Gaten home to historic Gaten Academy, an institution of which Clay had heard vague rumors. He thought it was one of those New England prep schools for kids who can't quite make it into Exeter or Milton. He supposed the three of them would be back in the land of Burger Kings, muffler repair shops, and chain motels soon enough, but this part of New Hampshire 102 was lined with very nice-looking homes. The problem was, there were shoes, sometimes as many as four pairs, in front of most of the doors. The foot traffic had thinned considerably as other travelers found shelter for the coming day, but as they passed Academy Grove Sitco and approached the fieldstone pillars flanking Gaten Academy's entrance drive, they began to catch up to a trio just ahead, two men and a woman, all well into middle age. As these three walked slowly up the sidewalk, they inspected each house for one without shoes placed at the front door. The woman was limping badly, and one of the men had his arm around her waist. Gaten Academy was on the left, and Clay realized this was where the music, currently a droning, string-laden version of Fly Me to the Moon, was coming from. He noticed two other things. One was that the road litter here, torn bags, half-eaten vegetables, gnawed bones, was especially heavy, and that most of it turned in at the gravel Academy Drive. The other was that two people were standing there. One was an old man, hunched over a cane. The other was a boy with a battery-powered lantern parked between his shoes. He looked no more than 12 and was dozing against one of the pillars. He was wearing what looked like a school uniform, gray pants, gray sweater, a maroon jacket with a crest on it. As the trio ahead of Clay and his friends drew abreast of the Academy Drive, the old man, dressed in a tweed jacket with patches on the elbows, spoke to them in a piercing, "I will be heard all the way to the back of the lecture hall" voice.
"Hi there. Hi, I say. Won't you come in here? We can offer you shelter, but more importantly, we have to..."
"We don't have anything, mister," the woman said. "I got four burst blisters, two on each foot, and I can hardly walk."
"But there's plenty of room,"
the old fellow began. The man supporting the woman gave him a look that must have been unpleasant, because the old fellow stopped. The trio went past the drive, and the pillars, and the sign on old-fashioned iron S-hooks reading, "Gaten Academy, established 1846. A young mind is a lamp in the darkness." The old fellow slumped over his cane again, then saw Clay, Tom, and Alice approaching, and straightened up once more. He seemed about to hail them, and then apparently decided his lecture hall approach wasn't working. He poked his companion in the ribs with the tip of his cane instead. The boy straightened up with a wild look, as behind them, where brick buildings loomed in the dark along the slope of a mild hill, Fly Me to the Moon gave way to an equally sluggish rendition of something that might once have been I Get a Kick Out of You.
Jordan, he said, your turn. Ask them in.
The boy named Jordan started, blinked at the old man, then looked at the new trio of approaching strangers with gloomy mistrust. Clay thought of the March Hare and the Dormouse in Alice in Wonderland. Maybe that was wrong. Probably it was. But he was very tired.
Oh, they won't be any different, sir, he said. They won't come in. Nobody will. We'll try again tomorrow night. I'm sleepy.
And Clay knew that, tired or not, they were going to find out what the old man wanted, unless Tom and Alice absolutely refused, that was. Partly because the old man's companion reminded him of Johnny, yes. But mostly because the kid had made up his mind that no one was going to help in this not very brave new world. He and the one he called Sir were on their own, because that was just how it went. Only if that were true, pretty soon there wouldn't be anything worth saving.
Go on,
the old man encouraged him. He prodded Jordan with the tip of his cane again, but not hard, not painfully.
Tell them we can give them shelter. We have plenty of room, but they ought to see first. Someone needs to see this. If they also say no, we will indeed give up for the night.
All right, sir.
The old man smiled, exposing a mouthful of large horse teeth.
Thank you, Jordan.
The boy walked toward them with absolutely no relish, his dusty shoes scuffing, his shirt tail hanging below the hem of his sweater. He held his lantern in one hand, and it fizzed faintly. There were dark, up-all-night circles under his eyes, and his hair badly needed washing. Tom? Clay asked.
We'll see what he wants, Tom said. Because I can see it's what you want, but...
Sirs? Pardon me, sirs?
1 second, Tom said to the boy, then turned back to Clay. His face was grave.
But it's going to start getting light in an hour, maybe less. So that old guy better be right about there being a place for us to stay.
Oh, yes, sir,
Jordan said. He looked like he didn't want to hope and couldn't help it.
Lots of places. Hundreds of dorm rooms, not to mention Cheatham Lodge. Tobias Wolfe came last year and stayed there. He gave a lecture on his book, Old School.
I read that, Alice said, sounding bemused.
The boys who didn't have cell phones have all run off. The ones who did have them...
We know about them, Alice said.
I'm a scholarship boy. I lived in Holloway. I didn't have a cell phone. I used to use the dorm mother's phone whenever I wanted to call home, and the other boys would make fun of me.
Looks to me like you got the last laugh there, Jordan, Tom said.
Yes, sir,
he said dutifully. But in the light of his fizzing lantern, Clay saw no laughter, only woe and weariness.
Won't you please come and meet the head?
And although he had to be very tired himself, Tom responded with complete politeness, as if they had been standing on a sunny veranda, at a parent's tea, perhaps, instead of on the trash-littered verge of Academy Avenue at 4:15 in the morning.
That would be our pleasure, Jordan, he said.
Chapter 12.
The devil's intercoms is what I used to call them, said Charles Ardai, who had been chairman of Gayton Academy's English department for 25 years
and acting headmaster of the academy entire at the time of the pulse. Now he stumped with surprising rapidity up the hill on his cane, keeping to the sidewalk, avoiding the river of swill that carpeted Academy Drive. Jordan walked watchfully beside him, the other three behind him. Jordan was worried about the old man losing his balance. Clay was worried that the man might have a heart attack, trying to talk and climb a hill, even a relatively mild one like this, at the same time.
I never really meant it, of course. It was a joke, a jape, a comic exaggeration, but in truth, I never liked the things, especially in an academic environment. I might have moved to keep them out of the school, but naturally I would have been overruled. Might as well try to legislate against the rising of the tide, eh?
He puffed rapidly several times.
My brother gave me one for my 65th birthday. I ran the thing flat.
Puff, pant.
And simply never recharged it. They emit radiation, are you aware of this? In minuscule amounts, it's true, but still, a source of radiation that's close to one's head, one's brain.
Sir, you should wait until we get to Tunney, Jordan said.
He steadied Ardai as the head's cane slid on a rotten piece of fruit, and he listed momentarily, but at an alarming angle, to port. Probably a good idea, Clay said.
Yes, the head agreed. Only I never trusted them. This is my point. I was never that way with my computer. Took to that like a duck to water.
At the top of the hill, the campus's main road split in a Y. The left fork wound its way to buildings that were almost surely dorms. The right one went toward lecture halls, a cluster of administration buildings, and an archway that glimmered white in the dark. The river of garbage and discarded wrappers flowed beneath it. Headmaster Ardai led them that way, skirting as much of the litter as he could, Jordan holding his elbow. The music, now Bette Midler singing Wind Beneath My Wings, was coming from beyond the arch, and Clay saw dozens of discarded compact discs among the bones and empty potato chip bags. He was starting to get a bad feeling about this. Sir? Headmaster? Maybe we should just...
We'll be fine, the head replied. Did you ever play musical chairs as a child? Of course you did. Well, as long as the music doesn't stop, we have nothing to worry about. We'll have a quick peek, and then we'll go over to Cheatham Lodge. That's the headmaster's residence, not 200 yards from Tunney Field, I promise you.
Clay looked at Tom, who shrugged. Alice nodded. Jordan happened to be looking back at them, rather anxiously, and he caught this collegial interplay.
You ought to see it, he told them. The head's right about that. Until you see it, you don't know.
See what, Jordan? Alice asked. But Jordan only looked at her, big young eyes in the dark.
Wait,
he said. Chapter 13.
Holy fucking shit,
Clay said. In his mind, the word sounded like a full-throated bellow of surprise and horror, with maybe a soupçon of outrage, but what actually emerged was more of a whipped whimper. Part of it might have been that this close the music was almost as loud as that long-ago AC/DC concert, although Debbie Boone making her sweet schoolgirl way through You Light Up My Life was quite a stretch from Hell's Bells, even at full volume. But mostly it was pure shock. He thought that after the Pulse and their subsequent retreat from Boston, he'd be prepared for anything. But he was wrong. He didn't think prep schools like this indulged in anything so plebeian and so smash-mouth as football, but soccer had apparently been a big deal. The stands stacking up on either side of Tunney Field looked as if they could seat as many as 1,000, and they were decked with bunting that was only now beginning to look bedraggled by the showery weather of the last few days. There was an elaborate scoreboard at the far end of the field, with big letters marching along the top. Clay couldn't read the message in the dark, and probably wouldn't have taken it in, even if it had been daylight. There was enough light to see the field itself, and that was all that mattered. Every inch of grass was covered with phone crazies. They were lying on their backs like sardines in a can, leg to leg, and hip to hip, and shoulder to shoulder. Their faces stared up into the black, pre-dawn sky.
Oh, my Lord Jesus, Tom said.
His voice was muffled because one fist was pressed against his mouth.
Catch the girl, the head rapped. She's going to faint.
No, I'm all right, Alice said.
But when Clay put his arm around her, she slumped against him, breathing fast. Her eyes were open, but they had a fixed, druggy look.
They're under the bleachers, too, Jordan said.
He spoke with a studied, almost showy calm that Clay did not believe for a minute. It was the voice of a boy assuring his pals that he's not grossed out by the maggots boiling in a dead cat's eyes, just before he leans over and blows his groceries.
Me and the head think that's where they put the hurt ones that aren't going to get better.
The head and I, Jordan.
Sorry, sir.
Debbie Boone achieved poetic catharsis and ceased. There was a pause, and then Lawrence Welk's Champagne Music Makers once more began to play Baby Elephant Walk. Dodge had a good time, too, Clay thought.
How many of those boomboxes have they got rigged together? He asked Headmaster Ardai. And how did they do it? They're brainless, for Christ's sake. Zombies.
A terrible idea occurred to him, illogical and persuasive at the same time.
Did you do it? To keep them quiet, or... I don't know.
He didn't do it, Alice said.
She spoke quietly from her safe place within the circle of Clay's arm.
No, and both of your premises are wrong, the head told him.
Both?
They must be dedicated music lovers, Tom mused, because they don't like to go inside buildings. But that's where the CDs are, right?
Not to mention the boomboxes, Clay said.
There's no time to explain now. Already the sky has begun to lighten and... Tell them, Jordan.
Jordan replied dutifully, with the air of one who recites a lesson he does not understand. All good vampires must be in before cockcrow, sir.
That's right, before cockcrow. For now, only look. That's all you need to do. You didn't know there were places like this, did you?
Alice knew, Clay said. They looked, and because the night had begun to wane, Clay realized that the eyes in all those faces were open. He was pretty sure they weren't seeing. They were just open. Something bad's going on here, he thought. The flocking was only the beginning of it.
Looking at the packed bodies and empty faces, mostly white, this was New England, after all, was awful. But the blank eyes turned up to the night sky filled him with unreasoning horror. Somewhere, not too distant, the morning's first bird began to sing. It wasn't a crow, but the head still jerked, then tottered. This time it was Tom who steadied him.
Come on, the head told him. It's only a short walk to Cheatham Lodge, but we ought to start. The damp has made me stiffer than ever. Take my elbow, Jordan.
Alice broke free of Clay and went to the old man's other side. He gave her a rather forbidding smile and a shake of his head.
Jordan can take care of me. We take care of each other now. Hey, Jordan?
Yes, sir.
Jordan? Tom asked. They were nearing a large and rather pretentious Tudor-style dwelling that Clay presumed was Cheatham Lodge.
Sir?
The sign over the scoreboard. I couldn't read it.
What did it say?
Welcome, alumni, to homecoming weekend. Jordan almost smiled, then remembered there would be no homecoming weekend this year. The bunting on the stands had already begun to tatter, and the brightness left his face. If he hadn't been so tired, he might still have held his composure, but it was very late, almost dawn. And as they made their way up the walk to the headmaster's residence, the last student at Gayton Academy, still wearing his colors of maroon and gray, burst into tears. Chapter 14.
That was incredible, sir, Clay said.
He had fallen into Jordan's mode of address very naturally. So had Tom and Alice.
Thank you.
Yes, Alice said. Thanks. I've never eaten two burgers in my life, at least not big ones like that.
It was 3 o'clock the following afternoon. They were on the back porch of Cheatham Lodge. Charles Ardai, the head, as Jordan called him, had grilled the hamburgers on a small gas grill. He said the meat was perfectly safe because the generator powering the cafeteria's freezer had run until noon yesterday, and indeed the patties he took from the cooler Tom and Jordan had carried in from the pantry had still been white with frost and as hard as hockey pucks. He said that grilling the meat would probably be safe until 5 o'clock, although prudence dictated an early meal.
They'd smell the cooking? Clay asked. Let's just say that we have no desire to find out, the head replied. Have we, Jordan?
No, sir, Jordan said, and took a bite of his second burger.
He was slowing down, but Clay thought he'd manage to do his duty.
We want to be inside when they wake up, and inside when they come back from town. That's where they go, to town. They're picking it clean, like birds in a field of grain. That's what the head says.
They were flocking back home earlier when we were in Malden, Alice said.
Not that we knew where home for them was.
She was eyeing a tray with pudding cups on it.
Can I have one of those?
Yes, indeed.
The head pushed the tray toward her.
And another hamburger, if you'd like. What we don't eat soon will just spoil.
Alice groaned and shook her head, but she took a pudding cup. So did Tom.
They seem to leave at the same time each morning, but the home flocking behavior has been starting later,
Ardai said thoughtfully.
Why would that be?
Slimmer pickings?
Alice said.
Perhaps.
He took a final bite of his own hamburger, then covered the remains neatly with a paper napkin.
There are many flocks, you know. Maybe as many as a dozen within a 50-mile radius. We know from people going south that there are flocks in Sandown, Fremont, and Candia.
They forage about almost aimlessly in the daytime, perhaps for music as well as food, then go back to where they came from.
You know this for sure? Tom said. He finished one pudding cup and reached for another. Ardai shook his head.
Nothing is for sure, Mr. McCourt.
His hair, a long white tangle, an English professor's hair for sure, Clay thought, rippled a bit in the mild afternoon breeze. The clouds were gone. The back porch gave them a good view of the campus, and so far it was deserted. Jordan went around the house at regular intervals to scout the hill sloping down to Academy Avenue and reported all quiet there as well.
You've not seen any of the other roosting places?
Nope, Tom said.
But we're traveling in the dark, Clay reminded him, and now the dark is really dark.
Yes,
the head agreed. He spoke almost dreamily.
As in Le Moyen Âge.
Translation, Jordan?
The Middle Age, sir.
Good.
He patted Jordan's shoulder. Even big flocks would be easy to miss, Clay said. They wouldn't have to be hiding.
No, they're not hiding,
Headmaster Ardai agreed, steepling his fingers.
Not yet, at any rate. They flock, they forage, and their group mind may break down a bit while they forage, but perhaps less. Every day, perhaps less.
Manchester burned to the ground, Jordan said suddenly. We could see the fire from here, couldn't we, sir?
Yes,
the head agreed.
It's been very sad and frightening.
Is it true that people trying to cross into Massachusetts are being shot at the border? Jordan asked. That's what people are saying. People are saying you have to go to Vermont. Only that way is safe.
It's a crock, Clay said. We heard the same thing about the New Hampshire border. Jordan goggled at him for a moment, then burst out laughing. The sound was clear and beautiful in the still air. Then, in the distance, a gun went off, and closer, someone shouted in either rage or horror. Jordan stopped laughing.
Tell us about that weird state they were in last night, Alice said quietly. And the music. Do all the other flocks listen to music at night?
The head looked at Jordan.
Yes, the boy said. It's all soft stuff. No rock, no country.
I should guess nothing classical either,
the head put in.
Not of a challenging nature, at any rate.
It's their lullabies, Jordan said. That's what the head and me think, isn't it, sir?
The head and I, Jordan.
Head and I, yes, sir.
But it is indeed what we think,
the head agreed.
Although I suspect there may be more to it than that.
Yes, quite a bit more.
Clay was flummoxed. He hardly knew how to go on. He looked at his friends and saw in their faces what he was feeling. Not just puzzlement, but a dreadful reluctance to be enlightened. Leaning forward, Headmaster Ardai said,
May I be frank? I must be frank. It is the habit of a lifetime. I want you to help us do a terrible thing here. The time to do it is short, I think, and while one such act alone may come to nothing, one never knows, does one? One never knows what sort of communication may flow between these flocks. In any case, I will not stand idly by while these things steal away not only my school, but the very daylight itself. I might have attempted it already, but I'm old, and Jordan is very young, too young. Whatever they are now, they were human not long ago. I won't let him be a part of this.
I can do my share, sir, Jordan said.
He spoke as stoutly, Clay thought, as any Muslim teenager who ever strapped on a suicide belt stuffed with explosives.
I salute your courage, Jordan, the head told him, but I think not.
He looked at the boy kindly, but when he returned his gaze to the others, his eyes had hardened considerably.
You have weapons, good ones. And I have nothing but an old single-shot 22 rifle that may not even work anymore, although the barrel's open, I've looked. Even if it does work, the cartridges I have for it may not fire. But we have a gasoline pump at our little motor pool, and gasoline might serve to end their lives.
He must have seen the horror in their faces, because he nodded. To Clay, he no longer looked like kindly old Mr. Chips. He looked like a Puritan elder in an oil painting. One who could have sentenced a man to the stocks without batting an eye, or a woman to be burned at the stake as a witch. He nodded at Clay in particular. Clay was sure of it.
I know what I'm saying. I know how it sounds. But it wouldn't be murder, not really. It would be extermination. And I have no power to make you do anything.
But in any case, whether you help me burn them or not, you must pass on a message.
To who?
Alice asked faintly.
To everyone you meet, Miss Maxwell.
He leaned over the remains of their meal, those hanging judge eyes sharp and small and burning hot.
You must tell what's happening to them, to the ones who heard the infernal message on their devil's intercoms. You must pass this on. Everyone who has had the daylight robbed away from them must hear, and before it's too late.
He passed a hand over his lower face, and Clay saw the fingers were shaking a little. It would be easy to dismiss that as a sign of a man's age, but he hadn't seen any tremors before.
We're afraid it soon will be, aren't we, Jordan?
Yes, sir.
Jordan certainly thought he knew something. He looked terrified.
What?
What's happening to them? Clay asked. It's got something to do with the music and those wired-together boomboxes, doesn't it? The head sagged, suddenly looking tired.
They're not wired together, he said. Don't you remember me telling you that both of your premises were wrong?
Yes, but I don't understand what you mean.
There's one sound system with a CD in it. About that, you're certainly right. A single compilation disc, Jordan says, which is why the same songs play over and over.
Lucky us, Tom muttered, but Clay barely heard him. He was trying to get the sense of what Ardai had just said. They're not wired together. How could that be? It couldn't.
The sound systems, the boom boxes, if you like, are placed all around the field,
the head went on,
and they're all on. At night you can see their little red power lamps.
Yes, Alice said. I did notice some red lights. I just didn't think anything of it.
But there's nothing in them. No compact discs or cassette tapes, and no wires linking them. They're just slaves that pick up the master disc audio and rebroadcast it.
If their mouths are open, the music comes from them, too, Jordan said. It's just little, not hardly a whisper, but you can hear it.
No, Clay said. That's your imagination, kiddo. Gotta be.
I haven't heard that myself, Ardai said. But of course my ears aren't what they were back when I was a Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps fan. Back in the day, Jordan and his friends would say.
You're very old school, sir, Jordan said.
He spoke with gentle solemnity and unmistakable affection.
Yes, Jordan, I am,
the head agreed. He clapped the boy on the shoulder, then turned his attention to the others.
If Jordan says he heard it, I believe him.
It's not possible, Clay said, not without a transmitter.
They are transmitting, the head replied. It is a skill they seem to have picked up since the pulse.
Wait, Tom said. He raised one hand like a traffic cop, lowered it, began to speak, raised it again. From his place of dubious shelter at Headmaster Ardai's side, Jordan watched him closely. At last, Tom said,
Are we talking telepathy here?
I should guess that's not exactly le mot juste for this particular phenomenon, the head answered. But why stick at technicalities? I would be willing to wager all the frozen hamburgers remaining in my cooler that the word has been used among you before today.
You'd win double burgers, Clay said.
Well, yeah, but the flocking thing is different, Tom said.
Because?
The head raised his tangled brows.
Well, because...
Tom couldn't finish. And Clay knew why. It wasn't different. The flocking wasn't human behavior, and they'd known it from the moment they'd observed George the mechanic following the woman in the filthy pantsuit across Tom's front lawn to Salem Street. He'd been walking so closely behind her that he could have bitten her neck, but he hadn't. And why? Because for the phone crazies, biting was done. Flocking had begun. At least, biting their own kind was done. Unless...
Professor Ardai, at the beginning, they killed everyone.
Yes,
the head agreed.
We were very lucky to escape, weren't we, Jordan?
Jordan shuddered and nodded.
The kids ran everywhere, even some of the teachers. Killing, biting, babbling nonsense stuff. I hid in one of the greenhouses for a while.
And I in the attic of this very house, the head added. I watched out of the small window up there as the campus I love, literally went to hell.
Jordan said, Most of the ones who didn't die ran away toward downtown. Now a lot of them are back, over there. He nodded his head in the general direction of the soccer field.
All of which leads us to what? Clay asked.
I think you know, Mr. Riddell.
Clay.
Clay, fine. I think what's happening now is more than temporary anarchy. I think it's the start of a war. It's going to be a short, but extremely nasty one.
Don't you think you're overstating?
I don't. While I have only my observations to go on, mine and Jordan's, we've had a very large flock to observe, and we've seen them going and coming as well as resting, shall we say. They've stopped killing each other, but they continue to kill the people we would classify as normal. I call that warlike behavior.
You've actually seen them killing normals? Tom asked. Beside him, Alice opened her pack, removed the baby Nike, and held it in her hand. The head looked at him gravely.
I have. I'm sorry to say that Jordan has too.
We couldn't help, Jordan said. His eyes were leaking. There were too many. It was a man and a woman, see? I don't know what they were doing on campus so close to dark, but they sure couldn't have known about Tunney Field. She was hurt. He was helping her along. They ran into about 20 of them on their way back from town. The man tried to carry her.
Jordan's voice began to break.
On his own, he might have gotten away, but with her, he only made it as far as Horton Hall. That's a dorm. That's where he fell down and they caught them.
Jordan abruptly buried his head against the old man's coat, a charcoal gray number this afternoon. The head's big hand stroked the back of Jordan's smooth neck.
They seem to know their enemies, the head mused. It may well have been part of the original message, don't you think?
Maybe, Clay said. It made a nasty sort of sense.
As to what they are doing at night as they lie there so still and open-eyed, listening to their music.
The head sighed, took a handkerchief from one of his coat pockets, and wiped the boy's eyes with it in matter-of-fact fashion. Clay saw he was both very frightened and very sure of whatever conclusion he had drawn.
I think they're rebooting, he said.
Chapter 15.
You note the red lamps, don't you?
The head asked in his carrying I will be heard all the way to the back of the lecture hall voice.
I count at least 63...
Hush up,
Tom hissed. He did everything but clap a hand over the old man's mouth. The head looked at him calmly.
Have you forgotten what I said last night about musical chairs, Tom?
Tom, Clay, and Ardai were standing just beyond the turnstiles, with the Tunney Field archway at their backs. Alice had stayed at Cheatham Lodge with Jordan by mutual agreement. The music currently drifting up from the prep school soccer field was a jazz instrumental version of The Girl from Ipanema. Clay thought it was probably cutting-edge stuff if you were a phone crazy.
No, Tom said. As long as the music doesn't stop, we have nothing to worry about. I just don't want to be the guy who gets his throat torn out by an insomniac exception to the rule.
You won't.
How can you be so positive, sir? Tom asked.
Because, to make a small literary pun, we cannot call it sleep. Come.
He started down the concrete ramp the players once took to reach the field, saw that Tom and Clay were hanging back, and looked at them patiently.
Little knowledge is gained without risk, he said. And at this point, I would say knowledge is critical, wouldn't you? Come.
They followed his rapping cane down the ramp toward the field, Clay a little ahead of Tom. Yes, he could see the red power lamps of the boomboxes circling the field. 60 or 70 looked about right. Good-sized sound systems spotted at 10 or 15 foot intervals, each one surrounded with bodies. By starlight, those bodies were an eye-boggling sight. They weren't stacked. Each had his or her own space. But not so much as an inch had been wasted. Even the arms had been interwoven, so that the impression was one of paper dolls carpeting the field, rank on rank, while that music, like something you'd hear in a supermarket, Clay thought, rose in the dark. Something else rose as well, a sallow smell of dirt and rotting vegetables, with a thicker odor of human waste and putrefaction lingering just beneath. The head skirted the goal, which had been pushed aside, overturned, its netting shredded. Here, where the lake of bodies started, lay a young man of about 30 with jagged bite marks running up one arm to the sleeve of his NASCAR t-shirt. The bites looked infected. In one hand, he held a red cap that made Clay think of Alice's pet sneaker. He stared dully up at the stars as Bette Midler once more began singing about the wind beneath her wings.
"Hi!"
the head cried in his rusty, piercing voice. He poked the young man briskly in the middle with the tip of his cane, pushing in until the young man broke wind.
"Hi, I say!"
"Stop it!"
Tom almost groaned. The head gave him a look of tight-lipped scorn, then worked the tip of his cane into the cap the young man was holding. He flicked it away. The cap sailed about 10 feet and landed on the face of a middle-aged woman. Clay watched, fascinated, as it slid partially aside, revealing one rapt and blinkless eye. The young man reached up with dreamy slowness and clutched the hand that had been holding the cap into a fist. Then he subsided.
"He thinks he's holding it again," Clay whispered, fascinated.
"Perhaps,"
the head replied, without much interest. He poked the tip of his cane against one of the young man's infected bites. It should have hurt like hell, but the young man didn't react, only went on staring up at the sky as Bette Midler gave way to Dean Martin.
"I could put my cane right through his throat, and he wouldn't try to stop me. Nor would those around him spring to his defense, although in the daytime I have no doubt they'd tear me limb from limb."
Tom was squatting by one of the ghetto blasters.
"There are batteries in this," he said. "I can tell by the weight."
"Yes, in all of them. They do seem to need batteries."
The head considered, then added something Clay could have done without.
"At least so far."
"We could wade right in, couldn't we?" Clay said. "We could wipe them out the way hunters exterminated passenger pigeons back in the 1880s. The head nodded.
"Bash their little brains out as they sat on the ground, didn't they? Not a bad analogy. But I'd make slow work of it with my cane. You'd make slow work of it even with your automatic weapon, I'm afraid."
"I don't have enough bullets in any case. There must be..." Clay ran his eye over the packed bodies again. Looking at them made his head hurt. "There must be 600 or 700, and that's not even counting the ones under the bleachers."
"Sir? Mr. Ardai?"
It was Tom.
How did you first..."
"How did I determine the depth of this trance state? Is that what you're asking me?"
Tom nodded.
"I came out the first night to observe. The flock was much smaller then, of course. I was drawn to them out of simple but overwhelming curiosity. Jordan wasn't with me. Switching to a nighttime existence has been rather hard for him, I'm afraid."
"You risked your life, you know."
"I had little choice," the head replied. "It was like being hypnotized. I quickly grasped the fact that they were unconscious, even though their eyes were open, and a few simple experiments with the tip of my cane confirmed the depth of the state."
Clay thought of the head's limp, thought of asking him if he'd considered what would have happened to him if he'd been wrong and they'd come after him, and held his tongue. The head would no doubt reiterate what he'd already said. No knowledge obtained without risk. Jordan was right. This was one very old-school dude. Clay certainly wouldn't have wanted to be 14 and standing on his disciplinary carpet. Ardai, meanwhile, was shaking his head at him.
600 or 700's a very low estimate, Clay. This is a regulation-size soccer field. That's 6,000 square yards.
How many?
The way they're packed together? I should say 1,000 at the very least.
And they're not really here at all, are they? You're sure of that?
I am. And what comes back? A little more each day. Jordan says the same, and he's an acute observer, you may trust me on that, is not what they were, which is to say, not human.
Can we go back to the lodge now? Tom asked.
He sounded sick.
Of course,
the head agreed. Just a second, Clay said. He knelt beside the young man in the NASCAR t-shirt. He didn't want to do it. He couldn't help thinking that the hand which had clutched for the red cap would now clutch at him, but he made himself. Down here at ground level, the stink was worse. He had believed he was getting used to it, but he had been wrong. Tom began,
Clay, what are you...
quiet. Clay leaned toward the young man's mouth, which was partly open. He hesitated, then made himself lean closer, until he could see the dim shine of spit on the man's lower lip.
At first he thought it might only be his imagination, but another 2 inches, he was now almost close enough to kiss the not-sleeping thing with Ricky Craven on its chest. Took care of that.
"It's just little," Jordan had said. "Not hardly a whisper, but you can hear it." Clay heard it, the vocal, by some trick, just a syllable or two ahead of the one coming from the linked boomboxes. Dean Martin, singing Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime. He stood up, nearly screaming at the pistol-shot sound of his own knees cracking. Tom held up his lantern, looking at him, stare-eyed.
"What? What? You're not going to say that kid was..."
Clay nodded. "Come on, let's go back." Halfway up the ramp, he grabbed the head roughly by the shoulder. Ardai turned to face him, seemingly not disturbed to be handled so. "You're right, sir. We have to get rid of them. As many as we can, and as fast as we can. This may be the only chance we get. Or do you think I'm wrong?"
"No," the head replied. "Unfortunately, I don't. As I said, this is war, or so I believe. And what one does in war is kill one's enemies.
Why don't we go back and talk it over? We could have hot chocolate. I like a tiny splash of bourbon in mine, barbarian that I am."
At the top of the ramp, Clay spared one final look back. Tunney Field was dark, but under strong northern starlight, not too dark to make out the carpet of bodies spread from end to end and side to side. He thought you might not know what you were looking at if you just happened to stumble on it. But once you did, once you did. His eyes played him a funny trick, and for a moment he almost thought he could see them breathing, all 800 or 1,000 of them, as one organism. That frightened him badly, and he turned to catch up to Tom and Headmaster Ardai, almost running.